tonight. How's it going, Sean?
Very good. I'm excited to be back in my old stomping grounds, back in Manhattan. I used to work down here for many years, and it's good to be back.
Yep, our new studio's in Manhattan. No more of that outer borough bullshit.
We went from being racist troglodytes of the outer boroughs to enlightened cosmopolitans of the bright lights big city.
Back to where my ancestors were, and probably a lot of your ancestors, too. Everyone was kind of here at some point or another.
I think so, yeah. Lower Manhattan, definitely. It's nice down here. I think someday we should, maybe someday soon, we should do a bonus about North Brooklyn losing the mandate of heaven and the mandate of heaven moving back.
The hipster mandate.
Yes, the hipster mandate moving back.
Probably
to
somewhere around when Vice bought those DIY venues and ran them into the ground.
Well, that was what, like 2017, 2016?
No, it was earlier than that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I would say that was the point where Brooklyn was no longer the spot.
But it was like Wile E. Coyote running off the cliff, and it's not till he looks down that he actually falls. It's the same thing. Like, I feel like North Brooklyn, I was in fucking Williamsburg recently, and I thought to myself, God, this is fucking terrible. This place is dog shit. It fucking sucks. It's like an old folks home for like 35 and 40 year olds. It's terrible. And then you come down here and there's such energy, such life. It's nice, man.
There's still a bunch of good spots in North Brooklyn. But
name one.
Spectacle Theater.
Okay, there you go. You got one. Well, let's move on. I think we have a lot of news to talk about today, and I'm not going to be angry, and I'm not going to be drunk. I'm going to be very reasoned and reasonable this time. We're going to talk about foreign policy, geopolitics. We're going to talk about Trump and Trumpism. We're going to talk about Canada, China, Minneapolis, and Israel. So those are basically all the places that exist.
We're not going to talk about Australia? We can't throw Australia
No. Australia is too cursed.
We've never talked about Australia, never will. All right. let's start with Greenland, because that's, think, like, that's the terrifying thing of the week, you know, in the news cycle, at least, you know, the week's early, but
there's got to be one thing every week. This is the one.
So I want to get your take on this. What do you think the Greenland thing is all about? I mean, people today are saying that Trump was mad about not getting the Nobel Prize, and he decided to no longer be a peaceful dove and instead become Hitler. They didn't give him the Peace Prize. They're like, all right, I guess
now
I'm Hitler.
I guess I'm Hitler now. I think that that's more than just what people are saying. I think Trump actually came out with a Truth Social post, or at least there was a leak from like a letter that he sent the Prime Minister. Do they have a Prime Minister or a President in Denmark? Probably a Prime Minister. He sent the Prime Minister.
It's the President of Norway, I think.
Oh, is it Norway?
Yeah.
Oh, because they're in charge of the Nobel Prize.
It would be funny if he sent to the Prime Minister of Denmark. It's like extra stupid.
Yeah. Extra racist towards Scandinavians. Like, what, we all look the same to you? Yes. But yeah, no, fucking, I guess, like, for some God, I guess there's a reason, but it's a stupid reason. It's actually the state of Norway that gives the Nobel Prize, because they were like endowed by Arthur Nobel, right? So he sent a letter to their prime minister and was like, hey, because you didn't give me the Nobel Peace Prize, I'm Hitler now. And then he started playing that Kanye song, the banned Kanye song. You know, we can...
Very catchy song, unfortunately.
I know, I hate that, dude. I fucking hate that. I hate that things are catchy. I hate that Kanye still got it, despite being Black Hitler. Anyways, I don't know, like, how far down this fucking road do we want to go that we've got since 2015 trying to, like, I don't know, I guess the libs would call it sane-wash Donald Trump. Other people would call
it... Let's use his term. You want to call him a lib?
No, I will call Tuz a lib all day long, in the best possible way. I think he's a lib. Do we want to like try to get at the daily, weekly news and try to put some sort of like broader analysis on it? What do we know about Trump now that we didn't know about him 3-4 years ago? I don't fucking know. It's like, I don't know. How do we ascribe motives to him? What does he actually believe? What does he actually want? This is like Kremlinology was during the Cold War. It was a whole cottage industry of like trying to understand what Brezhnev was thinking. And, you know, I'm sure the Soviets did it in the United States, too. Is there a point to it? Probably, because we want to know what the fucking future holds for us. But something feels off in this. I feel like we're not getting the whole story here.
Well, he does kind of offer different explanations for it all the time. Yeah. But what makes the most sense to me is that he is correct that NATO wouldn't work without the United States. The United States is such a central part of it, and if the U.S. were not aligned to NATO, what would NATO really mean? You know, I guess, you know, they have nukes, but the United States is the central component of NATO, and even with the European nations increasing their military spending towards NATO, it's the United States is still by far the largest military. Trump just always comes out and says he wants to make it. He wants to make the military budget like $1 trillion bigger, you know, on a whim. So it's only going to get bigger. And so I think Trump saying like, well, if we're keeping NATO afloat, then why don't we get to call the shots of like how Europe works, who's in power in Europe and how the territory is used. And as a symbol of that, I'm going to just play Risk and take Greenland, which is, you know, it's in Risk. You know, you do want Greenland as a bridge between
you do want and you also want Kamchatka too, very important to get into the Eurasian landmass, you know, if you want to fight a land war in Asia. So maybe we'll try to buy that from fucking Putin or something.
That's too hard to say. It doesn't really have the appeal.
That's true. Doesn't have the same appeal. Greenland rolls off the tongue though. I guess my question in that analysis for you then would be, so you're saying that Trump understands as like the deal maker that he has, let's call it leverage over the EU or at least like the European part of NATO, and that he's applying this leverage in such a way. He sees this as a deal to be made.
He sees the entire world as a deal to be made. Mm. And it's only limited by, you know, his will is just has for decades shaped the world around him. And he's almost never been stopped in any way. And so his life is kind of like this fever dream of like, you know, he's like lucid dreaming our reality. And I'm just going to imagine something and do it. And who's ever going to stop me?
Yeah.
Oh, it seems like nobody can stop me for some reason. I must be omnipotent on some level.
Sure.
And so now we're getting to a point where he's Hitler.
Yeah.
And the, you know, Europe has to decide whether they're going to finally stop him, and if they're able to, or if they're even going to try. And their first attempt to stop him was sending what, you know, what Trump says is a second dog sled to defend Greenland, which is very funny.
It's very funny.
But yeah, sending what, like a dozen troops there, I guess, just as like targets, you know, if like America wanted to invade, you're going to have to kill these troops and that'll trigger the Article 5 or whatever. I maybe that's what they were doing. I'm not sure. And Macron's now talking about this so-called anti-coercion tool the trade bazooka.
Trade bazooka, which was first, I just learned, designed to keep China from coercing Europe. But apparently the implements that they put in place in case China came are now being used, or, you know, the idea of them is being used against the idea of Trump taking Greenland. So interesting little turnabout there. I guess, you know, China not the main threat anymore. We are. You know, you say that Trump has always wanted to raise the military budget, but I remember him running when he was running the second time, third time, God. He said something about, I would like to get in there. I'd like to cut the military budget in half. We can spend.
Oh, yeah. I think he said that one time.
He said that one time.
No, it was after he was elected this recent time.
After he was elected.
Yeah, he said, I'm doing so much good for peace that we're not going to have... we're going to be able to do military drawdowns internationally.
Right.
It was pretty cool, but he seemed to have forgotten about
immediately. Forgot about it. It's like, what do the ancients say about a life worth living, or like a regular individual's life, let alone a political person's life? You have to know your own mind. And like, to an extent, I feel like Trump, it doesn't seem like he knows his own mind. It seems like these ideas flit into his brain and then he kind of gets fixated on them. One thing's for sure is that the motherfucker doesn't read, and he doesn't really pay much attention or really remember much about the world, like past maybe the second or third person that spoke with him. And so I feel like there's something has like lit upon his addled, damaged, brilliant brain, genius brain that he has where Greenland is like a an ID fix for him. There's something in this, and maybe this is ascribing too much to Trump because he's famously an idiot. But he's also famously a fucking very stable genius. So take, you know, do what you will with this. You know, what's going to happen? One of the things that the EU, after they sent their second dog sled over there, one of the things they said they were going to do to penalize the United States if we did take Greenland, either by force, which is unlikely, but more likely coercion, is they would kick all U.S. military bases out of Europe. And I think we have 9 of them at this point, including like Ramstein, which is the really big one, including the one in Germany that we basically run the Ukrainian war out of. There was a lot of articles in the Times about that. But it's interesting. It's like, how cognizant is Trump of the effects of his own actions? Which is another way of saying, like, is there a world, there's pure speculation, is there a world in which Trump, the realist, right? Because like you said, he's got his imprint on the world now, realizes that there's no political stomach in the United States to withdraw from Europe, and like Obama and Trump have wanted to do, pivot towards Asia, right? There's no stomach in that for that in the U.S. Congress and what we might call the deep state or the permanent government or the blob, as Obama called it, would not really allow that to fall down. So wouldn't it be great to antagonize your European NATO allies so much that they kick the U.S. out? And then it's like they do the dirty work for us and we get to leave Europe and I guess send troops over to Asia, send troops to occupy Colombia and Mexico or whatever. So this is like very 3D chess, and you're arguing that he's playing Risk.
Right.
Potentially he's playing Monopoly because there's also all these rare earths up there in Greenland too.
Sounds more like Catan.
Settlers of Catan. Yeah, I mean, who's going to go live up there? Not me.
And who plays Catan better than the Germans, by the way? So we'll have to see what the Germans have to say about this. All right, but yeah, I mentioned this trade bazooka thing.
Trade bazooka.
Which is, the New York Times says it's limitations on big American technology companies or other service providers that do large amounts of business on the continent. And this is what Macron is calling for Europe to use. Why don't they do what China did during their trade war last September and just start dumping U.S. securities, dumping bonds? That seemed to be what backed Trump off last time. Is China in a position to do that and Europe isn't?
China's been, since 2014, slowly getting rid of its American securities, its T-bills and all that stuff, and moving towards a basket of other currencies and commodities, as I understand it, you know, as I follow these things. What finally defeated the U.S., I think, in the trade war last year was China basically blockading rare earth exports to the U.S., including very precise magnets, which apparently are necessary for military industrial production and also car production as well. They also send cheap chips, I think, to the United States as well. So that combination basically lost us the trade war. You know, some combination of, like you said, securities, but also then industrial rare earths or whatever. So Denmark, interestingly, I just read this, also has a chip to play. So if Macron's bazooka was insufficient, apparently 74% of the insulin consumed in the United States comes from Denmark. So you
had the, and the fat drug.
And Ozempic, yeah. 100% of Ozempic comes from there, 74% of the insulin. So, like, it's interesting because I looked at a thread on X.com, the Everything app, and there are people saying, like, well, Denmark would never do it. And then folks were saying, well, they said they might do it. Like, well, they would do it, but we'd be able to replace that insulin, no problem.
Yeah, the anarchists can start making it.
The anarchists, could, just like they're making the fucking the glasses, beans. Prescription glasses, and whatever. It turns out that it would take like 6 to 18 months to like to replace that production under the best of circumstances. And everybody knows that insulin shock starts within, I think, 12 to 24.
We know we're fucked if Kennedy comes out and says, actually, we don't need insulin. Yeah. Actually, insulin's bad for you if you're diet. That causes diabetes.
You just need raw milk and you need to, like, I don't know.
Do you believe the raw milk conspiracy theory that the whole milk campaign was because that they wanted it to be a raw milk campaign, but the milk company said, yeah, you cannot do that. What are you trying to do here?
I haven't heard that conspiracy, but it's plausible, I guess. I don't know. What do you think?
I don't know what the fuck they're doing with this milk shit. They're fucking psychos.
Like the most reasonable MAGA people out there, and I've used that term reasonable very advisedly, are like, there's two real intellectual heavy hitters within the Trump administration. One of them is J.D. Vance. I'm like, okay, yeah, I really think of him as a heavy hitter. And the other one,
comparatively,
yeah. One's like Robert F. Kennedy Jr., like the intellectual heavyweight. And like, that's not a very deep bench, man. That's pretty fucking rough. Pam Bondi, right? She's a complete fucking...
No, I don't think anyone's saying that.
Yeah.
There's this guy, there's like this Duganist in the Trump orbit named Darren Beatty or Betty, but he has like kind of a low level job, but he's like a real kind of Dugan Nazi type.
So he's like the Gorka of last administration.
Yeah, in terms of like you've got like an esoteric weirdo who's sort of connected to white nationalist circles.
But the Gorka thing didn't make sense until we had Connor and Henry on. I guess that episode isn't coming out until later this week, but we had them on to talk about it. It turns out Gorka, very well connected to like the right in Europe. And presumably like this guy is the entryway for Duganism into America. So in the fifth, when Trump runs for his third term, in like 8 years, 7 or 8 years or whatever, and he wins, then we'll see that there was this hidden Duganist kind of like entryism the entire time, maybe.
But the guy Trump really listens to, of course, is this one 40-year-old bald
virgin. Steve Carell.
He has a wife. He has a wife. He's being cucked by Elon Musk. He doesn't seem to.
Elon Musk's dick doesn't even work, according to rumors.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the worst part.
Do you hear that?
That's the worst part about being cucked by Elon Musk.
Cucked by a guy who can't even get a hard on.
Yeah, if it's just this, if the media is to be believed and Stephen Miller is just like the one feeding all of this,
yeah,
and the entire world is worried that Trump is Hitler, it seems like a pretty easy solution.
Oh, now you're going to have to censor yourself. You were censoring me last episode. You're going to have to bleep that out, bro. You're talking about, I actually don't disagree with you on that, so you can bleep me out too. But I want to, before I forget, we have this wonderful book, The German Revolution, 1917 to 1923, by Pierre Bruet, in front of us, just because I happen to be reading it right now. And I'm at the part, you know, very early in the book. This is written by Trotskyist in the 1970s with a lot of primary sources. In the very beginning of the book, when the Great Betrayal happens, you know, 1914, and you have like Schneiderman, you have Ebert, you have all these fucking monsters who basically destroyed the Social Democratic Party as a Marxist party. And I think it's fair to say at least complicit in the deaths of millions of Germans and French and Brits and whatever in the First World War. Anyways, when I think about Trump and I think about Greenland, I think about Keir Starmer. I think about Emmanuel Macron and I guess Friedrich Merz and Ursula von der Leyen and fucking Maloney and all these people. I see them, these Europeans, as direct heirs to the fucking
social... But they're going to use the trade bazooka.
Yeah, I know, those fucks. On
they're
us.
Gonna take out Miller with the trade bazooka.
On us, God damn it. I'm going to catch flack from that. But I think... I'm not saying this about our European friends who live in Europe. I wish you guys the best, but I really wish you would overthrow your ruling class. Because when I look at the people over there, not that I look at Trump or Miller like positively, but I think of Schneiderman and Ebert when I see Keir Starmer and I see Emmanuel Macron. I think about the death of socialism, proletarian socialism, and the rise of, since 1923, like a disgusting ruling class that needs to be overthrown. And just because they're European and just because they have like a nicer social model than us, to me, that they shouldn't be absolutely fucking run over. Should it happen with the United States military and our power? Absolutely not. That's just capitalist on capitalist. But like, I shed no fucking tears for Ursula von der Leyen and Kaya Kallas and fucking Maloney and all these people getting their asses reamed out by the United States in this instance.
Well, you know who might be the ultimate accommodationist for Trump in this Greenland thing is the Baltic states.
Ah, yes.
Because they are, you know, in addition to Finland and Poland, more at the front lines of Russian aggression. I'm not sure how Russia would feel about Trump taking Greenland, because it's like, you know, Greenland is like right next to Russia.
Yeah, sure.
Because of the way the Earth is shaped like a sphere.
So is Alaska, too, though. So we're already there.
Yeah.
You know, Sarah Palin can see Russia from her house.
If the whole Ukraine thing was about too much NATO on Russia's borders, sure, then the militarization of Greenland would certainly be an acceleration of that.
Indeed.
But I guess that's kind of what Trump's point is. Anyway, the Baltic states are extremely anti-Russian.
Oh, yeah. For historical reasons.
I didn't know
reasons.
This, but Estonia actually has a sizable Russian-speaking minority. And they have, in recent years, entirely disenfranchised them. They're no longer able to vote.
Right.
So if there's any country in Europe that Russia has a claim for like intervening against after Ukraine for, you know, to liberate a Russian speaking minority, it would be Estonia.
It would be.
And so I think the extreme anti-Russian nature of those states, I think they'd be the quickest ones to say, yeah, just give Trump Greenland. Like, we can't stop fucking around. You know, we're toast if like NATO falls apart.
Yeah, these little chihuahuas up there in the Baltics. You know, it reminds me, Estonia always reminds me of that famous load-bearing tweet from years back. I think from before when Elon Musk bought the site, but maybe not. But it was the one about Estonians were polishing the balls on Polish war horses until the Soviet Union brought them up into sapience. Like, I don't actually believe that, but I think it's always funny to think of Estonian, like Baltic nationalism, Lithuanian nationalism, Latvian nationalism. Think about it in terms of like a post-imperial sort of order that hasn't been fair to anybody. Hasn't been fair to the Baltics. Hasn't been fair to really anybody. These people's anti-imperialism is a very reactionary one, I feel like, because what they object to with the Soviet Union was, I guess, the suppression of their indigenous ruling class and the substitution of that for like a quote unquote Russian one or whatever. But really, like, they were pissed like everybody else that their slaves were taken away, you know, under that last system. So, you know, you have these Baltics, you have the Polish, less so nowadays, but still the Polish and others who have a history of being part of the Warsaw Pact and have this mythology of like Soviet imperialism crushing their national aspirations, who have become the most war-fevered group within NATO and is actually dragging much of the kind of Western European NATO groups farther towards like militarization and World War III than I think they might otherwise go, which is a very interesting dynamic, which is why these chihuahuas that exist there in the Baltic are scary to pay attention to, because it seems like they'd actually prefer World War III than they would, I don't know, giving voting rights to the Russian population. I don't know what it seems like to you. Like, this is all...
Yeah, I don't really know much about Estonia. You know, what I think about is a comic strip by the late artist Scott Adams.
Oh, yes. R.I.P. to a legend.
That portrayed Estonia as Elbonia, a country where everyone wears funny hats and wades through knee-deep mud at all times.
Nice. Yeah.
I don't think that's actually what Estonia is like. I'm sure it's a lovely country. It did get rid of the Jews faster than any other country in Europe, including Germany.
It did that organically.
That was a long time ago.
It did that organically because, again, these nations were always like split between East and West, and that they exist in their modern form up into the 20th century, like through Prussian imperialism, like a Prussian ruling class with all that comes with that, kind of hegemonizing its power across these regions. And then they were torn between Nazi Germany and Stalinist Soviet Union. So we shouldn't be surprised that their politics are like a little fucking suspect anyways.
All right. So now, next question. Canada is going to be kind of caught in between the new American Greenlands and the United States. And Trump is still talking about invading Canada or taking Canada in some way, which seems even sillier than Greenland in a sense, because it is more of a country than Greenland is.
Yeah.
And there was a, Michael Moore made a funny movie about this.
It was a Canadian bacon.
Canadian bacon, yeah, in the late 90s.
There was also Blame Canada, right?
Like, sure, and South Park as well. Yeah. So Canada recently had President Xi, the dirtbag left's favorite dude, was just in Canada, and they cut a deal. And yeah, what do you know about that?
Oh, fucking, the Chuds are so mad about it. Because they thought, I don't know what they thought. I guess you could just, America's got so much power, so much economic sway, so much military preponderance, that so many great goods and services to sell the world, that you could threaten countries like Canada or France or Germany and never get any pushback. Well, you know, as it turns out, inside fucking NAFTA now, inside the North American Free Trade Region, you have Canada basically, it seems like, pushed into the arms of China. And good for them, I must say, because the current deal, as I understand it, is that China is going to drop its tariffs on canola oil, which I guess is a really important export of Canada, in exchange for China dropping its 100% tariffs on Chinese electric vehicles down to 10%. Now, if I'm Canadian, God forbid, but if I was Canadian and I like was looking at cars to buy, a BYD, I think you can pick one up for like $12,000, and it's got all the bells and whistles, it's like fully electric.
They're gonna have BYDs in Canada.
Oh yeah, they're gonna have BYDs. Oh, wow. That's the big headline thing. And so,
well, can we just go up there and buy one, bring it to the United States?
I think you'd have to like draw in Sharpie like Toyota on the back so you don't get hit with
the chargers work
100% tariffs. I don't know how the chargers work. We're reaching the limits of my knowledge of BYD and Chinese cars or whatever, but the Chuds are they're up in arms about the whole thing. It's like, what did you fucking expect, you stupid shit? Steve Bannon's like, this is a betrayal by one of our closest partners. It's like, have we been treating, you know, the Canadian ruling class nicely recently? The Canadian people, for that matter, nicely? I mean, some people think that the Greenland thing is actually to encircle Canada. We could encircle them and impose...
is that necessary? Are we worried that the residents of the Northern Promises are going to break out and do a pincer maneuver on
the fucking an amphibious assault from Newfoundland or whatever. Yeah, this is the sort of speculation. This is like, if we can manage to not be scared, we can actually have a little fun with it, because all anybody can do is speculate, you know, like, and these kind of speculations are really fun. But the Chuds also say too that the BYD electric cars, when they come into Canada, are going to be on the roads to surveil. They're going to give all the intel to the Chinese Communist Party, who's going to use that for what? I don't know. Like, there's wheat fields in Alberta, or fucking Winnipeg is really seasonal in July, or there's a great bar in fucking, I'm trying to think of another, Edmonton has like a really great fucking place you can get Labatt Blues for $3. Like, I never understood what the Chinese Communist Party would want with like the TikTok data, or what they would want with BYD data. What would they want? Like, what would they get besides what you can see on Google Maps, you know, like road view or whatever they call it, you know? So anyways, the fucking Chuds are losing their minds over this shit. I say good for Canada, man. Open up free trade. I think that Europe should do that. European ruling class, and they'll never do this because they're such fucking cowards, and they bought into like this sort of rules-based international order bullshit that Biden was talking about. They would never do this, but they should start fucking taking like Chinese imports, you know? They should fucking...
Do they not?
They have tariffs too, and they're putting more up now because they can't compete with Chinese industry. You know, China has reached a level of relative industrial capacity around the global capitalist economy on par with what the United States had at the end of the Second World War. And that's like an incredible, incredible world historical realization of capitalist spread, capitalist progress, capitalist accumulation. The fact that now, like in relative terms, industrial capacity, the majority of industrial capacity exists in one nation, in China. And this, I think, people know, based, you know, how power shifted after the Second World War, what a nation might do with that industrial capacity if they wanted to.
Yeah, just one thought about Venezuela, which, you know, it seems so long ago. I don't know if anyone could have predicted the way, you know, it seemed like something was going to happen, but the exact way he pulled it off, which was to just take out Maduro and his wife and then leave the Chavismo bureaucracy
incredible
in power.
Stuff. Yeah.
Like, could anyone have predicted that?
No.
And that, I wonder if that's going to be his model for regime change all over the world. They'll just take out Carney and, like, leave the rest of the parliament to, like, choose the next leader. It doesn't matter who it is.
Yeah.
And he'll just appoint himself to the president and tell them what to, they can have, like, a semblance of democracy.
Sure.
But there's a new ruling class, which is just the Trump administration,
right?
That will just punish them if they don't do, like, just through direct force.
Yeah.
Like, and that's how, I mean, that is how the United States has ruled the world for decades now.
It's like gunboat diplomacy. You know, it's actually it's a much more naked form of aggression and coercion than what we saw in the 20th century, certainly in the second half of the 20th century. But it's like, it kind of does the same thing, right? It wants to implement like an American friendly regime that runs by the rules of international law and all that shit, but more importantly, right, is anti-communist and does our bidding and accepts our capital. But, you know, I was thinking about this too earlier. This is in relation to Venezuela and Greenland, like what connects those things? Because maybe nothing does. Maybe this is just as haphazard as it appears, and that's entirely possible. I don't want to concede that to, like, the liberals, you know. I don't want to concede that to, like, the, you know, like, white liberals were right the whole time, like Neera Tanden said recently. But, you know, there is, I think that there's something there in that maybe both in Venezuela and in Greenland, we ache for there to be like a final solution to it. Like we want this to end. And so we want Trump to come and, like, one way or the other, whether we like it or not, to, like, complete what he's trying to do in both of these nations, do regime change, like take out the Bolivarian government there, or annex Greenland and take it over, when maybe the point for our great deal-making president is not actually to complete anything, but to maintain leverage and continue deal-making and negotiations for forever, I guess. Like, maybe, like, the point of Greenland and Venezuela is not to have some final fucking denouement to these incidents, but to actually have a permanent hold on Venezuela, a permanent blockade, to take all of their sanctioned ships whenever we want, to impose upon them, like, not a government of our choosing, but enough coercion that we can get the Venezuelan state to do what we want in perpetuity. Same thing perhaps with Greenland. This just flows from what we know about Donald Trump and his self-understanding as, like, a deal maker, you know?
And a guy who wants everyone to be nice to him.
Be nice to him. And what better way for him to get people to be nice to him than to, like, threaten to blow them up or charge them with narco trafficking and snatch them from their presidential palace in the middle of the night, or blow up their dog sleds or whatever the fuck.
Yeah. I mean, it's so, you know, this is like my deep fear for the future. It's not necessarily about Trump, but, like, as long as we have nuclear weapons, chances are at some point, someday, some psycho is going to use them just because he's a psycho, you know? This is why we need to get rid of nuclear weapons, right?
You deeply depressed me the other day when we recorded with Connor and Henry, because at one point towards the end, you were just like, oh yeah, World War III is coming and there's nothing we can really do about it. We got to just, like, wait for, I guess, the mushroom clouds to pop up.
Well, that's what
and,
Mark said.
Yeah, well, Marx actually didn't know about nuclear weapons. Marx could not have anticipated the mutual ruin of the contending classes. I'm not saying you're even wrong. I'm just saying, like, for me, hope always springs eternal. And every time the mercurial and capricious deal-making president of ours make another capricious move to do something around the world that doesn't make any sense, maybe to my detriment, maybe to my folly is trying to like make sense of it, or at least ascribe to it, if not like purposive action on the part of our president, at least try to say like there's got to be some something real that at least he's reacting to. And now in many incidents, I haven't actually been able to find the rational kernel in inside of his demented brain. But I think to keep trying and to imagine that like there might be a content to history, that it's not just like we're being dragged willy-nilly into our ultimate destruction, our apocalyptic destruction by World War III. Maybe it's cope, but that's how I want to live anyway. I'd rather live coping than... I don't know. Just give it all up.
I don't blame you. I mean, it's just, you know, reading what people were saying and thinking in the 30s, it just feels like we're on the same trajectory. And
I think we're in the teens. I think it's 1912.
All right. That's much more optimistic.
And there's no German revolution.
Although still very bad.
Yeah. There's not even a German revolution to fail us. So maybe that analogy falls apart.
Well, let's move on to talk about the war at home, which increasingly looks like the war not at home.
Yeah.
And talk about Minneapolis. And you know, we've talked a lot about resistance to ICE on the show before, but I wanted to maybe talk about this in a more economic way. And I hope that's not too sterile a way to talk about it, because you know, we have a lot of listeners in Minneapolis, and you're in a war zone, and we have total love and solidarity for what you're going
through.
But it's just, you know, watching this from afar, it seems like this invasion of Minneapolis is just causing so much chaos. And really, it's hard to imagine how things might be going normally. Maybe things are normal there. You know, we heard this horror story of the ICE agents going to a Mexican restaurant during the day and then arresting the employees at night. So maybe that's some indication that the stores are still full, the restaurants are still open, you can still go see a Dillinger Four or whatever, despite the sporadic street battles. But it makes me wonder, you know, what would mean to the U.S. economy if the economy of Twin Cities or of, you know, central Minnesota itself just collapsed or became inoperative? What, you know, what if there was a general strike or like something more like a real insurgency there? What would that matter to Trump? Would that matter to the U.S. economy? What's the point of leverage for Minnesota workers as a whole?
I thought you were going to say for a second, what's the point of Minnesota? And that I don't have an answer to, if only because I've never been
there
before.
Well, it's a lovely place.
I'm sure it is.
I don't, but that this sort of is my question, is I don't know.
No, I mean, it's an interesting question, because the question raises, I think, the limits of our power, and by our, I mean broadly, the forces arrayed against what is an illegitimate and increasingly reckless Gestapo arm. I think people have cleverly called them Proud Boys 2.0. I think it's fair to call them like lumpen security forces, like the Lazzaroni of the 21st century. Now, like, why do I say illegitimate and reckless? Well, within your question of like what would power look like if workers in Minnesota, migrant and native workers, were to shut down the economy, like, is like we're imagining that power exists. I'm not sure that it does. I think that if events 5 years ago didn't like shut down the Minnesota economy or like large swaths of the central United States, then I'm not sure that the forces exist to do that in Minnesota. But it's, I think, important to put that marker down, because it shows kind of what our imagination might be and how to stop ICE from doing what ICE is doing, DHS doing what it's doing, without having to rely on political persuasion within like the Democratic Party. Because I'm not sure if you saw, but like, was it in the Congress or the Senate? There's a new plan by the Democrats to, I think, give an extra like $2.4 billion to ICE for like further training in de-escalation tactics. And like, this is their response. That's, you know, this stupid. Is always it's their response. So this is always their response. This is their response after George Floyd was murdered. This is their response in the face of, I dare to say, like a broad-based, even bipartisan, normie rejection of what they've seen in Minneapolis across this country. When I was so angry and drunk and black-pilled, I guess, God, it was only a week and a half ago or whatever. Part of that was that, and now this is, I guess, like shows my media consumption habits, but I wasn't seeing any pushback from like normies, you know, from like the wing of the Republican Party, which always claimed that it was like the party of Reagan, the hegemonic sort of like limited government wing. You know, I didn't see any pushback from that. Now, you know, after a week and a half or so, the pushback has come and the polls have come out, and it seems like Americans across the country are morally and practically revolted.
Yeah, especially people who are seeing it firsthand.
Oh, absolutely. The people, did you see that great video? I don't know if we could find it and punch it in, but if we can't, that's okay. It's of this like this Minnesota, like working class Minnesota guy. He's like, I've never been out. He's talking to a reporter. I've never been out here to protest anything before. My brother protests. He told me to come out here. He said, yeah, I'm out here because I'm pissed. He's like, these people coming to our community, blah, blah, blah. You know what he has to say after that. But he's like just a normal fucking dude, like not a protester, not an activist or whatever. So like the Trump administration has lost large swaths of the American population who do truly believe, as I said, that ICE is illegitimate and also reckless, right? But the question is, and this is the one that you raised, is what leverage, what power do we have as working class people, or God forbid, as a class have outside of Minnesota or even within Minnesota to operate in such a way that the popular discontent and the feelings of revulsion at this particular aggressive and violent government agency aren't just turned back into the same bullshit that we've seen, God, fucking our entire lifetimes, which is it being, of course, co-opted and brought back into a sort of milquetoast programmatic call by the Democratic Party, which never gets done.
Yeah, that's not really what I'm talking about, though. I'm talking about the spirit of the aggression towards Minneapolis. It's got a similar attitude as occupying a hostile territory, which the United States has done our whole lives, but it's usually not white people.
Right.
And yeah, what brought this thing on was anti-blackness, you know, targeting Somali people and Hmong people and Latin American people. But there seems to be no real clear racial line in terms of who ICE will attack and harass and kill. So it sort of feels, just from watching it, that the Twin Cities has been rendered surplus population. And they're willing to go as far as they want to destroy and dispirit that city without any interest in keeping it functioning economically, let alone keeping the people loyal to keeping the federal government legitimate to people in Minneapolis.
So
what I'm thinking is, like, what's the stakes? I think on a nationwide scale, like if the war on the American worker and average American people that's beginning with ICE going after immigrants were extended on a nationwide scale, obviously, you know, the American economy would break down because there just wouldn't be manual worker, you know, a huge percentage of the manual workforce would be deported or in prisons and that sort of thing. But could he have that war on a rolling basis from like blue state to blue state? Like, what would that cause economic catastrophe in some way?
I see what you're saying. I think that's kind of the point, isn't it? Right? Like, I think about this in terms of like bourgeois ideology. You know, Trump being a man who bought up distressed real estate and destroyed much of like its treasured ancient history, and then put up like glass skyscrapers and gaudy, disgusting towers or whatever. That is ultimately creative destruction, right? That's Schumpeter's creative destruction, Marx's creative destruction, this idea that like old ways had to be moved past and that you needed to break things in order to have new things. I feel like in Minnesota, in quote unquote blue states, as you say, which is just to say urban areas, because largely they're governed by Democrats in this country for historical reasons. The point, I think, is to rejigger the class equation, is to violently dispossess people who are quote unquote illegal or undocumented or whatever, to throw them out, to violently pull enough of them out that the rest of them leave, in order to like creatively free up all those jobs for, I guess, like, I'm using quotations here, like basement dwelling incel white kids, I guess. It's the same sort of thing. Like, people are like, oh, but these tariffs are so damaging to the U.S. economy. I think Trump and Vance and all these people, I think when they're at their most revolutionary, certainly Steve Bannon, to the extent that he has a lot of influence, when they're at their most like counter-revolutionary or revolutionary, you might call it, or even progressive from standpoint of capital, when they are their most revolutionary is when they're saying the tariffs are meant to cause pain. They're meant to be destructive of an old order, and we want to build up a new one. Steve Bannon called himself like the Lenin of the deep state or whatever. You want to go up and smash it up. I think there's a similar sense that like if we simply torture and arrest and what's voluntarily deport tens of millions of immigrant workers in this country, that after the dust settles, maybe it'll take like 6 months in Minneapolis, maybe it'll take like 9 months in Boston or whatever. When it all comes around, the native born American population of this country, our native capitalists will pick up the slack, the small businesses will pick up the slack and create a whole new economy, and it'll actually be a rebirth of things. So I don't think that this chaos we see here is incidental. I think that like we have true counter-revolutionary revolutionaries on our hand who understand that tariffs are going to destroy American industries, and they say, good, let's shake up the auto industry. Let's shake up let's get rid of the auto workers union. You know, unlike Biden, who's like UAW strong or whatever, Trump and them, you know, fucking they can exist or they cannot. But the point is we don't want electric cars. We don't want to keep going the route that things are going. We're going to institute like a petro state in the United States. So I'm not sure that I think that these people are scared of the chaos. I think that they're actually breeding the chaos on purpose to try to rejigger, to fundamentally resort out the American economy in Minnesota and elsewhere.
So you see them as trying to initiate a period of devastation, ethnic cleansing and political chaos, and then rebuilding in the aftermath of that.
In the ashes. Yeah.
Yeah. And maybe Trump doesn't have that vision because he's just a narcissist, but maybe like the Silicon Valley and the erectionaries waiting in the wings think they're going to hold the reins at that point.
Who is Stephen Miller? Stephen Miller is a kid from Beverly Hills, California, who, as I understand it, had a very prosperous like early life, and then his father's like real estate development company was destroyed, and he blamed immigrants for it somehow. I don't know, but the point of him is that he's a ruined petty bourgeois. Like, he's like a ruined rich kid who's been able to psychologically put like all of his life's troubles, all of his humiliation and not being rich in Beverly Hills anymore, whatever the fuck went on in this sicko's brain, able to put that all on immigration, put that all on immigrants and become Hitler, you know? And I don't think that Trump himself thinks that he's becoming Hitler. And I don't think that he actually is Hitler, but he's surrounding himself by people that are deeply imbued with Hitler particles, like people who are petty bourgeois to the fucking core and like represent this very contradictory, counter-revolutionary, creative, destructive impulse within segments of the American ruling class that want to shake everything up. The devastation, the ethnic cleansing, as you say, the creative destruction is the point for a lot of them. And I think that there's times when those people are predominant and there's times when they're not. I think within ICE and that leadership and the DHS and the Justice Department, I think that they're willing to shake it up. They're not willing to like release the Epstein files, but they're more than happy to start fucking ethnically cleansing Somalians out of
Somalis.
Thank you. Out of Minnesota, if it comes to it.
One last thing to say about this. I was thinking that maybe some of Trump's imperial ambitions and his like ethnic cleansing drive here, you know, I was wondering if maybe he was using Israel's war after October 7th as a model, because I remember when this war started, we were talking about, well, this seems like it'll be disastrous for the Israeli economy. They're becoming more of a pariah state than they've ever been. There's a brain drain and all this stuff. But the Israel economy, their stock market and the value of the shekel has actually gone up quite a bit since the war started, and seems very healthy on that level. So I thought I'd do some reading into how that happened. And the story is pretty interesting. You know, I heard one narrative that because Israel is sort of winning these wars or asserting itself as, like, you know,
regional hegemon.
Yeah, this exactly. That there was a lot of investment just on that basis, just on that they can call the shots for this entire region. But a couple of articles that I've read recently, more from an anti-Zionist perspective, and I'll put those in the show notes, from Jacobin and another's from 972 Mag, claim that a lot of that is an illusion. A lot of that's a bubble, because when the war happened, there was this sort of military Keynesianism where they gave reservists this incredibly high salary. That's like four times the normal minimum wage. So
$8,000 a month, yeah, man. That's like more than I make. Yeah. That's a lot of money.
So Israeli reservists were making $8,000 a month, and they didn't have to spend it because they're doing a genocide.
Yeah, and, right.
So they were just putting that money into the Israeli stock market, and that is explanation for both the continuation of consumption as normal within an economically devastated or stagnating at best economy, and the seeming rise in the value of shekel. And not only that, but it seems like there's some understanding within the Knesset, within the cabinet, that this is what Israeli society and economy needs to be from now on, a nation in uniform, where instead of going to the office, you're going to war. And it's and so taking that back to looking at the United States, it does seem like there's a sort of Keynesianism going on here. Anyone can join ICE. Anyone can join, can become a prison guard. Anyone can become a cop. You get a big bonus when you sign up. There's rumors that you get a bonus every time you detain someone. And not only that, but you have an increasing amount of freedom to dole out pain and run your own little crime syndicates as a member of ICE.
Or the IDF.
Or as a prison guard or whatever you want.
Yeah.
Because, you know, being a civil servant or a soldier or a cop, there's no longer the concept of discipline and of loyalty and of legitimacy and of doing public good is decreasingly part of the story. You know, there's not even the veneer of it anymore.
It's the $50,000 bonus you get for signing up for ICE.
And we've heard there's been numerous videos of people taunting ICE officers and saying, why are you doing this? And they're like, I don't have a college degree, and they gave me $50,000. And so I think ICE, the culture of it, but also the way it's been able to grow, is that it's a reflection of the lumpenization of the American lower middle class, upper working class. Is that not only is any kind of job necessary if you want to have any kind of meaningful existence in America, like buy a house, you know, start a family or whatever, but also to get that money, you have to enact enmity amongst your neighbors, your fellow citizens, fellow workers or whatever. You have to punish them, and that's how you get ahead. And that's in many ways the hidden logic of capitalism, right? It's a dog eat dog world. And I think we're just seeing that act out, both on the scale of ICE, on the international scale, on the, you know, Seth Harp's reporting about the way these military op forces are kind of like these rogue operators who are, you know, it's no longer about the army coming in. It's about these squadrons of assassins who are all drug dealers and psychos.
Right.
And so this is like a vision of the way the world works, where everyone can be their own little warlord.
Yeah. And they could be their own little warlord. They can have their own racket, right, is what we're talking about. But also, everything's spec ops nowadays. Like, what is it that we did in Venezuela? We did special operations, right? We did like a very complicated operation where we bought off some guys. There were rumors that America used like unheard of types of like sonic weapons that have never been used before. The prosaic reality is that we bought off part of their government to make the air defenses go down, and then we flew in fucking special operators, right? Everybody gets to be a special operator nowadays. When it comes to Israel, you know, this Jacobin article wants to call it military Keynesianism. There is an element of that, you know, like a lot of the growth in the Israeli economy as it is recently has been in like cybersecurity and basically like selling for export the means and methods they've used of destroying the Palestinian population, of oppressing the Palestinian population to other governments, other states, other private enterprises like Palantir and Google across the world. So like the military Keynesian aspect of it exists, but military Keynesianism is like, okay, so we're going to build a bunch of bombs which are going to be non-productive ultimately, but they're going to make a lot of money for contractors. And then people are going to be able to work in those factories and they're going to be able to make a wage. So there's like an industrial component in between the military and like the economy, right? There's an industrial. But what we have here with just like giving tons of money to fucking Israeli reservists is more like, less like military Keynesianism and more like zone of interest Keynesianism. It's like, you're gonna be part of a genocide. You're gonna be part of an ethnic cleansing, a destruction in part or whole of a people, and you're gonna get paid really well. So consumption wise, you're going to do great. You're going to live in like a beautiful hilltop overlooking, I guess, the Palestinian village that you denuded of people, overlooking the olive groves that you knocked over. But you're going to make $8,000 a month, you know, with a signing bonus on it. So it's like almost darker even than military Keynesianism. It is, again, this like lumpenization of security. Like it's like turning it into its own fucking racket and like turning the individual IDF bulldozer operator into like a well remunerated subcontractor for a genocidal state. It's
not like a war economy where you're adjusting your economy to the war. It's creating war in order to have an economy.
Right. Yeah. It's like substituting, like the industry doesn't even matter. It's like the industrial destruction of other people becomes the actual product, you know what I mean?
Right.
And the actual producer and consumer of that product is the military, is like the individual service member. You know, they're both like the object because you have to keep them happy, but also the subject of this. Like they need to go out and ply their skills, I guess, at oppression and violence.
And the only way that can work, because, you know, the production of a gun, you know, guns are not productive tools. They're right. Only destructive. So the only way it can work is if these conflicts expand without ends.
Yes. Well, they got the right man for the job, Bibi Netanyahu, right? Things have been quiet on that front for a while, right? But like, I kept thinking, because this article about Israel's military Keynesianism was in Jacobin magazine. And shout out to my friends who are editors and writers over at Jacobin. I like you as people. But like, methinks that Jacobin feels kind of betrayed, since like ultimately their socialism is broadly a kind of like Keynesianism. Even their Marxist socialism is kind of Keynesian. They feel like upset maybe that Keynesianism is being used in such a dishonorable way, what I guess would be otherwise an honorable enterprise, when of course we know that Keynesian ideology is like essential to capital accumulation in the 20th century, and we shouldn't be celebrating. It's not our tool that the Israelis are making disreputable, right? Keynesianism is capitalist tools. But this is where I kind of want to continue with the Israel thing. I had another black pill moment when I looked through all these links that you sent from following along with this 972 Mag article about the Israeli genocide and the economy. When you start clicking through these articles, like the Times of Israel article or this press release from the Bank of Israel, right? You see absolute fucking monster. You know who Smotrich is? Benjamin Smotrich, right? This is like the face of modern evil. This guy is like a settler fanatic and a genocide heir, right? You see him when you click through these articles standing in front of a nice podium in like in a room somewhere and talking about tax policy, talking about finance, talking about regulation, talking about making sure that the capitalist economy of Israel keeps humming in a way that Jerome Powell or anybody, Friedrich Merz, anybody else might say. And then you realize that, you know, people on the left and the right have created this conspiratorial, or like revived this conspiratorial worldview. Like people on the left using the term ZOG, Zionist Occupied Government, you know, like this concept that the Israeli state is all powerful and like controlling the media and controlling the United States or whatever. We're all familiar with this bullshit. And people get like really titillated by this idea, right? That this is like the one thing, just like the right wing, like the immigrants are this one thing that if we get a hold and a handle on it, will change the, it's the key to everything. People just about Israel. But what is sicker and I think more depressing is that Smotrich, who usually pops up 99% of the time I've seen him, it's been him saying like, we have to withhold food from Gaza. We need to increase the settlements in the West Bank. We need to get all of these Palestinians out of Judea and Samaria and Gaza. We need to kill all the children, expel them, yeah, blah, blah, blah.
He's a big opponent of Trump's plan for the technocratic plan for Gaza, because right. they want to have Palestinian technocrats like fulfilling the whims of the Tony Blair NGO.
Yeah.
And he's like, no, we should have psycho settlers do it. Yeah. What are you talking about?
We already have like a democratic way of doing this. Like get the fucking crazy settlers to do it organically. Right. Yeah. And then it's way sicker to imagine this guy like a Jerome Powell type, you know, after the genocide is completed, just sitting there and dealing like a bog standard capitalist technocrat, sitting there and like futzing around with tax policy and financing to ensure that like the capitalist economy of Israel continues.
I mean, the Nazis did this too, right?
Yeah, I
think the big difference though is, you know, Israel is this tech economy, right? They make software. Basically, sure. That's what their economy is.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, they have like these arms dealing partnerships and they're able to like get some money from the United States and stuff. But really when it comes down to it is they write cybersecurity software.
Right.
And in the last few years, a lot of the people who are leaving Israel, a lot of them are leaving for good, and they're selling their companies as they do. So this is creating a crisis for that aspect of Israeli industry. I think he's trying to neoliberalize it in a way to sort of keep it stable. That was my reading of that article.
That's about right.
My understanding of it's pretty limited.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I'm no expert on the Israeli economy, but you get my point, right? It's like we've spent so much time rightfully being morally horrified by the exceptional nature of the Israeli state and the exceptional violence that it's been doing in response to October 7th for 2.5 years now. But one of the chief architects of the ethnic cleansing and genocide now, this settler fanatic going back into what his primary role is, which is finance minister, I think tells something about how maybe not abnormal Israel is. And this was a take that you and I had like a year and a half ago, where it's like, is Israel a normal capitalist state? Well, it has a lot of aspects of it that are quite normal, and it has aspects of it that are quite abnormal. But ultimately now, even after the violence and massacres that we've seen ensue, it has the ability to revert to a normal, you know, even using the same fucking actors, a normal capitalist state like any other. And that's scary. And that's sick. That's sicker and scarier than the idea of Zog.
It's not really, I guess you could debate whether like the USSR was a normal capitalist state or eventually was a normal capitalist state. But capitalism is this normalizing force.
Right.
So, of course, a capitalist country is going to be normal.
Yeah.
As long as it's plugged into this normalized world system.
And it has to accumulate to remain normal. Yeah, for sure. Also, the other thing that I brought, I don't know if you managed to read it, but it was a fascinating op-ed that arose in the New York Times. There's a guy named David French that writes for the New York Times. You know about this asshole?
I heard the name.
Yeah. He famously, he was installed in the New York Times op-ed page, I guess, to kind of like be a never Trumper type conservative guy. He's like a former JAG, like Air Force attorney, I think. He's just got like, he's like very milquetoast, you know. But he came out with, interestingly, an op-ed in the Times that was about a guy named Ernest Frankel, who was a labor lawyer in the Social Democratic Party of Germany, a Jewish one, actually, who stayed in Germany through the 1930s, only really left when I think in 1939, because he had a special dispensation from the Nazis because he fought in the trenches of World War One. But this guy, Ernst Frankel, came up with a theory on what he had seen inside Nazi Germany and the rise of the dictatorship there that he wrote about. He wrote this book that basically argued that it was, you know, we think, oh, the Nazis took over and they just implemented this totalitarian dictatorship, because that's ultimately what the Nazis wanted everybody to think. And that's what the people who are like pro-Nazi or anti-Nazi today are afraid of, right, is this sort of totalitarian, authoritarian takeover. But what Frankel says, and, you know, this is what French reiterates here, is that, in fact, there was a kind of a dual state system, not dual power, but like a dual state system where you had a citizenry, I guess Aryan Germans, you would call them, non-leftist Aryan Germans, for whom like the laws, the rule of law still held, that you had a certain amount of stability, that you were immune from arbitrary violence or arbitrary oppression by the state, and that at least up until the Second World War began for Nazi Germany, was a normative state that kind of used a lot of the same rules, certainly in the economy, but also politically, as the Weimar Republic had before it. However, what the Nazis implemented was a dual state system, because very quickly, with the rise of the concentration camps, of course, later on the death camps, but the concentration camps for undesirables and communists and socialists, breaking up union meetings and things of this sort, you had what was called a prerogative state that grew alongside and actually within the normative state of Germany in the 1930s. And so David French is a contemporary of ours, a conservative, right, a never Trump type guy, writing in the August Gray Lady, the New York Times, about how Renee Good, the smile on her face that you saw right before she was shot in that face three times by an ICE officer, she thought she was living in the normative state where ICE has no ability to detain, let alone harm a white citizen born in this country, right? When instead she realized, I guess too late, or we all realized in her death, in her murder, that she had actually happened upon the prerogative state within the normative state. The prerogative state being a sort of earlier form of like, it's the king's prerogative to dispense justice arbitrarily if he so wills it, a personalistic, violent, sort of like pre-Boudoir prerogative state. So Renee Good ran into that, and the argument is that if Trump is creating a dictatorship, right, that if he is this totalitarian, if he is this Hitler, right, we know Stephen Miller is Hitler, but if Trump is trying to like put his totalitarian imprint on things, we shouldn't look for all of a sudden our civil liberties to disappear all at once, but instead the growth of a sort of prerogative state within the normative state. Kind of like one set of laws for one people, one set for another, kind of like a return to, I guess, a Jim Crow type situation. So I found it very interesting to look at this article. I don't know if you did, but to look at this, because I think it shows that there's a sort of intelligentsia, liberal intelligentsia, who's trying to kind of understand this moment in time in a way that's not hyperbolic, that's kind of analytic, and using this sort of dual state conception, this Nazi conception, not in maybe a hysterical way, but in an analytic way, to try to understand what has been, I think all of us realize, a real threat to like the rule of law in this country.
Well, the way that I've understood it is there is a Nazi concept that's called Gleichschaltung.
What the fuck is Gleichschaltung?
It's translated as coordination or consolidation,
uh-huh,
or streamlining.
Okay.
And it's the taking the state power is typically considered neutral, right? And so these conservative revolutionary movements are able to use the neutrality of the state when they come to power to put these non-state wings of their movement into power, you know, these nationalist clubs, paramilitaries, yeah, racialist circles, that sort of thing. So you put all these hooligans and weirdos and eccentrics and extremists into power. And then they're able to kind of put pressure on the rest of the neutral apparatus of the state to kind of follow their lead on things. And it's this sort of transfer. It's not like a Leninist, like, seizing and smashing state and rebuilding it. It's kind of putting this, like, parasitic wing onto the state. Like, Doge was
doing. Yeah.
Like, we're going to come in. We're going to access all your systems. We're going to cut whatever we want. We're going to fire whatever we want. We're going to terrify everybody. And at the end of it, everything is going to be sort of rebuilt in our image.
Yeah.
And so this only works as long as there's enough bureaucrats, or they can find enough bureaucrats who are competent enough to just sort of like follow the Fuhrer in that sense, or like work towards the Fuhrer, like do whatever the leadership says. So far, I think what we've seen from the Trump administration is mostly spectacle. I don't think that they've really drained the swamp or anything like that, you know? And I think this gets to the heart of the sort of intrigue between Rubio and Vance and Miller, you know, and these kind of tensions are starting to bubble up slowly, where Rubio is sort of leaking to the press that, like, don't worry, I'm still like a centrist conservative. I'm doing all these Nazi things to like stay in the Trump world's good graces, but I'm still the rational actor here. Right. I'm trying to put Machado in power in Venezuela.
Trying to constrain
them.
Yeah, I'm like the guy on the inside, sure.
And so, yeah, I mean, in this situation, the way to resist is, you know, if you're a bureaucrat, if you work for an institution, you're a teacher or whatever, or if you're just, you know, someone who lives in the city where these things are taking place, whatever, the way this stuff gets slowed down is just not to comply with it in whatever way you can, or try to resist it in any way you can, slow its operation in any way you can. And what we're seeing is not a population that's massively terrified into submission, but people who want to resist everywhere they can, whenever they can. And that's the, you know, in this is another way that Israel is not normal, right? Yeah. Because socially, the country's very on board with the genocide. And people here, even though they voted for it, like Trump said he was going to do this ICE stuff, the mass deportations, people voted for it. People liked it.
Yeah.
But when they see it, they don't like it and are starting to fight back wherever it rears its head.
Right.
And so that's going to make that sort of consolidation very difficult. The only challenge to it is that the only party within the state that can really stop it or roll it back are the Democrats, and they like it. They're on board with it.
Yeah.
They're just loyal opposition, and I think they know it. You know, the way Schumer responded to the good killing, I think, was the best indication yet.
What did he say?
He said that, what happened in Minneapolis is very disturbing. This is why police need to work with federal law enforcement. He took ISIS side.
He took ISIS side. Of course he did. There's no opposition party. As you said, they're a loyal opposition, if anything. And this, I think, like, I always have this tendency, you know, I always want to pour cold water on everything. And I try to anyways, like this, this David French bullshit, this idea of trying to like understand a dual state thing as like a novel thing, or as like a Hitlerian imposition upon rule of law, which I guess otherwise has bound our society for so long. You can see if a dual state exists, if a normative and a prerogative state exists in this country, or if Trump is bringing one into being. I can tell you there's been one our entire lives. There's been one since like at least since like 1981 or so, right? Like on paper, according to the Section 7 of the National Labor Relations Act, employees shall have the right to self-organize, to form, join, or assist labor organizations, to bargain collectively through representatives of their own choosing, and to engage in other concerted activities, that means strikes, for the purpose of collective bargaining or other mutual aid or protection. That is the law of the land. It has been for 85, 90 years or something at this point in time, right? That is the normative law of the land. But we all know, right, going back 50, 60 years or so, right, that there has been a prerogative state, that there has been within the private sector, with the help of many governors and mayors and senators and congresspeople and presidents and bureaucrats, with the help of all of them, there has been a lawlessness that has arisen within the capitalist economy in this country that exists alongside labor law, that in fact, this entire migrant crisis, quote unquote, is a reflection of the fact that there has been two laws, there has been two labor laws in this country for decades, right? And that, like, what Trump is doing, of course, is like an escalation of this. What ICE is doing is, of course, an escalation of this. But, like, ICE, okay, where do they get all these assault rifles? And they've got all this great fucking... this great military-grade material. We all remember. We saw it happening. We saw the blurring of the lines between the global war on terror and governance and security and law and order at home when all those fucking, all those municipalities, all this, these local police departments through this country starting in the mid to late aughts started to get Humvees, right? And started to get fucking tanks and armored personnel carriers and body armor and fucking... what night vision goggles and all this shit. And like, we're like, wow, okay, that stuff, that surplus stuff from Iraq, now it's not being used. It's coming back to our communities. If there has been a dual state, right, it has been fucking coming for a long time. And if you're David French, you can't say that you're fucking surprised by this, because working class people in this country aren't fucking surprised by it. People who have been trying to organize unions for the last 50 fucking years knows that there is the law on the one hand, there's arbitrary power and violence on the other hand. It's like, okay, David French, it finally took you this long to catch up, but welcome to the world that the rest of us have been living in for our entire fucking lifetimes.
Yeah, I haven't read that French article, but it doesn't sound very convincing to me.
It's on the surface convincing. It's interesting enough, right?
But yeah, for sure, the people who are, you know, terrorized by this Glockenschlong or whatever it's called, by this consolidation of like conservative revolutionary psychosis in the federal level, you know, you're already like, there's a sense by people in Minneapolis, like the guy you talked about earlier, that I don't care about any of this stuff, but I'm gonna be tear gassed now, or like, you know, I can't go drop my kids off at school without being worried about being pulled out of my vehicle by men in masks, you know?
Yeah.
I'm already on the other side of the law just based on where I live. And so once you see that, you realize you are part of this castaway class, which is, you know, I mean, this is like part of the excess of the Trumpian strain of neo-fascism is like, They're not protecting white people.
No, you know, like, no.
If they could, they just contented themselves with terrorizing Maduro and Latin America and Africa and
the Inuit and the people East. Of Greenland.
Yeah,
sure.
Well, the thing is, they don't even care. Like, that's not a factor. No one gives a shit about Denmark. Doesn't care about them. No one cares about them.
Yeah.
But they're fucking with Europe. They're fucking with white people. With the whitest white people.
Yeah, civilized people. Yeah.
Yeah. And so this is where the things might be coming to a head. You know?
Yeah. It's,
and even with his far right allies like Le Pen.
Yeah. Yeah. No. So that actually ties in nicely with like maybe some final thoughts on this French thing, because I think that these are connected, right? These two worlds, these two states, these dual states, right? Not to be confused with dual power, but like these dual states that this Frankel gentleman back in the 1930s saw in Germany and David French sees happening now with the murder of Rene Good by ICE officers, right? It is true that two worlds exist, but those worlds are not a normative state and a prerogative state, right? This isn't like an issue of... laws or rule of law versus like some outside arbitrary thing. Two worlds do exist, all right, and they are reflected in the material substrate of the real community of capital, we call it. The two worlds that exist are CMC and MCM prime. You know, these are ultimately the worlds that exist. In one world, you know, in the gated communities outside St. Louis or Rio de Janeiro or Tel Aviv or Shanghai or on the Upper East Side.
Are you saying finance versus production?
No, absolutely not.
I hope not.
I'm talking about capital versus the working class. I'm talking about this fundamental division here. He wants to have an idealist dialectic, right? Fucking bourgeois theorists, intellectuals love to have an idealist dialectic, right? We have to have a materialist dialectic. What are the great worlds that exist? There is the world of the ruling class and there's the world of the working class. And in Rio de Janeiro, Tel Aviv, Shanghai, or on the Upper East Side, in gated communities, there is rule of law. Right. There is safety and there's comfort and there is increased consumption. Actually, I think 50% of the consumption in this country is now done by the top 10%. And there is opportunity to move around. However, you know, David French would have us believe that this is the world of MCM Prime that most people have lived in, you know, our entire lives. And finally, now we're seeing a transition out of that. Right. But we know because we've read Phil Neal, we've read David Harvey, we've read Mike Davis, what the world, our world of CMC is like. We, people like you and me, and presumably the listeners at home, we can't be gaslit into believing that like this is like a new and definitive break from like a world of safety and comfort and order that we all lived in. I guess David French lived in, I guess like the rich people on the Upper East Side, but we can't be gaslit into that. Even MAGA. Many of them can't be gaslit into that because we've seen what the world is coming to for people like us, normal people, right? It's a kind of combined and uneven lawlessness that exists right now in this country. And David French and those people are feeling it, but people have felt it for a long time. So against this idea of the dual state, I would argue that there is the experience of the vast majority of humanity, the working class, the proletariat of this world, whether native or migrant, right? In fact, these migrant people were quote unquote brought in or allowed in partially to discipline us, right? To pit these workers against us, right? And this is the world we know, this is the world we're familiar with, but this hyper-exploited workforce in these gray areas of labor law, right, are now feeling the full force of the prerogative state. Now, we must defend them from what I'll say once more, and importantly, is both an illegitimate and reckless federal power. But we need to remember that this is just an expansion of existing terrors. I think all of us have felt throughout our lifetimes as working class people, but now encompassing greater and greater spheres of everyday life and also taking on a character that might be qualitatively different, even as it just compounds upon unfreedoms, exploitation, and oppression that we've felt for our entire lives.
Yeah, I mean, it's reminding increasing amounts of people that solidarity isn't just this nice idea that leftists believe in because they read a zine or listened to folk punk or something. Right. It's like the experience of it's their memory of what led to the workers' movement and what made the workers' movement successful in its heyday. And so now people are starting to learn what solidarity really is in their daily lives.
Yeah, and we need to be careful of our solidarity because or how solidarity is used, because I notice solidarity being used more and more by the leaders in Europe to try to get Trump to back off Greenland, saying we have solidarity with the Kingdom of Denmark in their struggle against American imperialism. It's very funny coming from like Germany and France and Britain, right? There is their solidarity that they have. They're like NATO solidarity, the European Union, the capitalist solidarity that they have amongst themselves. Ultimately, their solidarity is meant to keep the world as it is, to keep capital accumulation going, to keep imperialism as a quiet thing that happens behind the scenes with like unequal distributions of the revenue of capital, hyper exploitation in some places and not elsewhere. That is the world that they want to keep going. Trump is inconvenient for them. ICE is inconvenient for them. What we're doing in Venezuela is inconvenient for them, not because they don't think that that's the role of great powers in the world or fundamentally that, you know, violence is outside the bounds of what's acceptable in this capitalist world of ours, but only because it makes these contradictions, these realities far too explicit when they're supposed to be implicit, right? Germany is supposed to put its thumb on the scale and put its hands around the neck of little Greece. It's supposed to throw Greece up against the wall. It's supposed to take its pound of flesh from Greece, but God forbid the United States or Russia or whatever starts to do that to Germany, because that's not the way the world works. So all of David French, fucking Mertz and Maloney and all these fucking people, Donald Trump, J.D. Vance, they're all fucking monsters, and they all need to be gotten rid of. And I'm not going to trust Chuck Schumer to fucking do a thing about it. And I'm not going to trust David French to like be able to theorize his way out of this, because I don't think they can, because they don't take
good news. Literally no one does. So.
Except for the New York Times, you know, they presumably pay him
114 people. Like, the readers don't even believe that shit.
Yeah, that's true.
All right, good talking to you, Sean.
Yeah, always
solidarity
a pleasure.
Solidarity forever, but solidarity. Not the kind you don't like.
No, good solidarity, not bad.
Friends, Greenland is a place where souls go to dry out. It is a vast and terrifying place of ice fields and tundra. Bereft of fire, and in the horror of its imposing irrelevance, there's a sort of peace. Peace of pain, the peace of nothing. Well, friends, I'll tell you what. I'm going there.